Welcome back, everyone. Last week, we had sort of framed the larger, first of all, the current situation of conversion in America. And we spent more of our time, I'd say, last week introducing the topic and thinking through, sort of reviewing some of the conversations in the American Orthodox community, American Jewish community around matters of conversion, and also in terms of acceptance in the Israeli community and the relationship with the chief rabbinate. We talked about the new GPS system, the GPS policies and standards system that was put in place by the Rabbinical Council of America, and the controversy that has surrounded that. And there have been many rabbis and community members who have been extremely supportive of that decision, and they felt that it addressed a number of key issues. That number one, there were rabbis who were going rogue, who were performing conversions in matters in ways that were not necessarily widely accepted. And while in an individual communal basis you can do that because I have my own standards and I answer my own questions, when it comes to a sort of national or global question that has ramifications for generations down the line, it's not so simple. And so there were Orthodox rabbis who questioned even their colleagues' conversions. Certainly the chief rabbinate began to raise basic questions. And so many have been supportive and said that although in an ideal world perhaps we would want a more decentralized kind of system, given the realities of converts being hurt, converts being rejected, people thinking that they had conversions that would be widely accepted, and then their son wants to go get married or what have you in Israel, and all of a sudden they find out 20 years later that this is a conversion that was not accepted by the chief rabbinate, and has dramatic ramifications and traumatic as well ramifications for the family. So in order to avoid that, number one. And number two, there were challenges in terms of a relationship with the chief rabbinate and making sure that the conversions are accepted, and this is a way of ensuring that goes relatively smoothly. The pushback has been equally fierce. Those who oppose this centralization, first of all, it takes away the power of local rabbis. Number two, it undermines not just the autonomy of individual rabbis, but really the larger system of how the rabbinate works in America. Quite frankly, how Judaism works, right? We don't have, as opposed to Catholicism, we don't have that, right? That central hierarchy. We don't have someone who speaks ex cathedra. We have local rabbis with local authority. It's always how it's been. Although we just happen to live in a flat world.
Although in Europe you have chief rabbis.
Yes. So
there is some centralization there.
Exactly. And many would say, well, that's just that, and those were government imposed rather than Jewish community imposed and so on and so forth. Right? Both in Western and throughout, you have different models. So there's some discussion about that. Many felt that it was a capitulation to the chief rabbinate and that we weren't standing up and we weren't, as American rabbinates, demonstrating leadership. There were concerns that now with the move toward higher standards and greater centralization, that prior conversions would be questioned, would be rejected, and that their converts who had taken their conversion for granted for quite some time, all of a sudden their questions had been raised. And there were factual debates around that, whether or not there were conversions, they were Geuyot, conversions that had been questioned or undermined, and there's sort of like back and forth around whether or not factually what had happened. And there's a lot of misreporting around this, especially when you have parts of the non-Orthodox Jewish community reporting about the Orthodox Jewish community. Sometimes the nuances, the details get lost in translation, and there is misinformation that's sometimes spread around. So that also is an additional challenge that kind of stirred the pot. And so the controversy continues until today. You still have rabbis who will convert outside of the GPS system. You have rabbis who do all of the above within the Orthodox. You have rabbis who will only convert within the GPS standards and policies. You have rabbis who are opposed and now on principle only a smaller number, a relatively small number, but some will only convert outside. You have a handful of rabbis who do both. Sometimes when they feel it's appropriate and it'll run smoothly through the Beit Din of America, which oversees the GPS policies and procedures, so then they'll go in that vein. And if they feel that there is a legitimate case that comes before them, and they feel that it would be either A, it would be widely accepted, or B, they feel that they can be honest with the family and say, we want to be straight up with you. I feel that this is a legitimate case of conversion. That's my psak. But I want you to know that not all of my colleagues in America will agree with that. And if you go to Israel, there's a chance that it may or may not be accepted. So I'm willing to go ahead with this conversion. I have three rabbis who are happy to sit on a Beis Din to support this because they trust me and they know that if I'm going to give them a case, it's going to be a legitimate one, and it's one that's reliable from my perspective and from theirs. But we want you to know that this is a risk that you run. And so just as if you went through a non-Orthodox conversion, then all likelihood it would not be accepted by the Orthodox rabbinate, so too there will be significant pockets that may not accept this conversion. And this way, at minimum, there's full disclosure.
This has all been driven by the Israeli rabbinate?
That's the debate. So those who are opposed say this is just a capitulation to the chief rabbinate, and those who are in support have said, while it's true that that was an element that precipitated movement on this issue, that the challenge of individual rabbis, of these rogue conversions, so to speak, has been present for decades on the American scene. And while it's true that in the 1990s, when these issues, or even late 80s, when these issues were first raised, in the end, for a variety of reasons, there was not a specific structure put in place, but that there was an awareness within the American rabbinate that this is an issue well before the chief rabbinate raised any questions. So this part of sort of the factual or interpretive questions that have been disputed is exactly that. That is one of the questions around which the conversation revolves. So that was the historical background that I wanted to review. We saw a number of texts and sources and so on and so forth. And we spoke about Rabbi Lookstein, who was here last year, and that great picture of him and Natan Sharansky on page 7. Transcript came up on Shabbos, those who were here. We then came to some of the sources, and we saw that with regard to the standing of converts in the community in general, that there's an ambivalence, and there's a recognition that, on the one hand, individuals who join the Orthodox community, I'm starting on page 10, we're not going to review all these sources inside right now, but that there's a sense that it can be challenging. That the Gemara says that sometimes the scenario of having converts within the Jewish community can be a challenging one, it can be difficult. That, on the one hand, there are individuals who are truly heroic, who step forward and want to cast their lot together with their people from the time of Rud all the way until times of today, and yet at the same time there's a recognition that as a community, in terms of handling and managing these issues, that it can be challenging. And the Gemara, even in a couple of places, has surprisingly sharp language, perhaps reflective of certain moments in history, but we all know that there are challenges of conversions for marriage. These are complex kinds of questions, even without sort of the global politics of the world that we live in today. That's been a challenge for thousands upon thousands of years, arguably going back to the time of Tanakh with Shlomo HaMelech and so on and so forth. So these are very long-standing kinds of issues. And the Gemara reflects that sort of ambivalence or the complexity of trying to navigate a world in which we want to honor these heroic individuals and integrate them with the community, but it can sometimes come with some challenges, Joanne.
I think you said last week, the last time we had, that some section of the Persian community are not pro-converts. Did you also say that Chabad is
that? I think Syrian.
Did you also say that Chabad?
Yeah, my impression is, I haven't done a lot of research around this, but my impression is that the contemporary practice of Chabad rabbis is generally not to get involved in conversions. Right. Not that they say you can't convert, but that they are not actively involved in converting. I believe it's for halachic reasons and for the complexity of exactly this whole range of issues. So that's the common practice. I imagine there may well be some individual Chabad rabbis who do go ahead with conversion. I don't know exactly what the landscape looks like, but at least in America, my impression is that that's been the practice.
The stance that they are already converted, No.
That's a different kind of thing. In the Syrian community, there are challenges in terms of marriage and so on and so forth. And I'm not familiar with that kind of scenario in Chabad.
We have the local Chabad rabbi, he's not new now, but he's in another town. Mm-hmm. But he was involved in some conversions.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be.
Maybe he was involved, but did he sit on the Beit Din? Also, might be a distinction.
I don't know if he sat on the Beit Din, but right. He was like this. This individual was like got very close to his family and mm-hmm. learned with him mm-hmm. for a very long period of time and great mm-hmm. depth and
mm-hmm.
so he yeah. was definitely
involved in the process at least. Good. Again, I don't know about fully the contours, but that's just my general impression, but definitely ask around. We pointed out that probably the fundamental issue, at least in American conversion, and we'll talk, God willing, next week on our usual in our usual slot at 10:30 on Tuesday. We'll talk about the Israeli scene and some of the challenges that are unique there and the Russian immigration and all of that. But in America in particular, and to a lesser degree in Israel as well, the fundamental challenge, I think, above all, has been that of the acceptance of mitzvot in terms of the halachic policies with regard to accepting converts. And that in many of these cases where there's some debate and some controversy around it, that really is typically the most common issue. Even the question of motivation...
I'm sorry, what is the most common issue?
The acceptance of mitzvot.
Oh.
And the question of whether or not the convert, A, is required to fully accept the mitzvot in order to be accepted as a convert into the Jewish community, and B, assuming that that is a prerequisite, what constitutes the acceptance of mitzvot? And when I mentioned last time, different communities have different standards. And
is it a prerequisite?
So that's what we're going to talk about. That's exactly where we're going to go today. So already in the Gemara, there seems to be some tension around this issue. And this is what we started to talk about last week, but this is really what I want to pick up with. If you take a look at source, the bottom page 11 is a little bit cut off, or the page number is a little bit cut off. The Gemara is not. Source 10. So the Gemara tells us a classic story with regard to Hillel and Shammai. Right, so this is, we started to talk about this last time, but we didn't have a chance to really elaborate. So this is a classic Gemara on Daf Lamed Aleph and Aleph 31a, and it's a narrative. It's what we call an agadita, agada. It's a sort of story time in the Talmud. Right, so when you're in the middle of some very difficult Talmudic complex analyses, and all of a sudden the Gemara says, okay, let's tell some stories. You read that sigh of relief, and you jump in and you enjoy it. So this is a fairly widely publicized one with regards to conversion. The sages taught reading English. There was an incident involving one Gentile who came before Shammai. Gentile 12 said to Shammai, how many Torahs do you have? This, by the way, is only one part of a longer series of incidents. He said to him, to the written Torah and the oral Torah. The Gentile said to him, with regards to the written Torah, I believe you, but with regards to the oral Torah, I do not believe you. This is reflecting some of the opinions of Sadducees and other sects at that time. Convert me on condition that you will teach me only the written Torah. So Shammai said, I'm sorry, you can't do part without the other. You have to accept the whole thing or you can't convert. So Shammai scolded him and cast him out with reprimand. The same Gentile came before Hillel, who converted him and began teaching him Torah. The first day he showed him the letters of the alphabet and said to him, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dal. Next day, he reversed the order of the letters and told him that an Aleph is a Tav, and so on. Right? So he taught him the opposite. And the convert said to him, but yesterday, right, you see where he's going with this? Right, what's he demonstrating? Right, the need for,
I told you so.
Right, the need for the oral Torah. Right, you need someone to, you need a true tradition in order to know how to interpret it. Because otherwise you've got a bunch of blank letters, but you don't know what to call them, you don't know what to make of them, you don't know what they represent. So this is his way of showing him the veracity, the import, the critical nature of Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah. So the convert said to him, but yesterday he didn't tell me that. So Hillel said to him, you see that it's impossible to learn what is written without relying on an oral tradition. Didn't you rely on me? Therefore, you should also rely on me with regards to the matter of the oral Torah and accept the interpretations that it contains. So this is interesting already because you have here a convert who at least initially said, I'm not accepting the whole thing. And yet, right, the Gemara seems to imply, and take a look at the larger context, it's pretty clear that Shammai is not the one who's being championed here. That Hillel's view is the one that the Gemara seems to support, appears to embrace. This is one of the classic stories in terms of Hillel being someone who's more embracing, in terms of Hillel, the outreach rabbi, you know, what have you. That kind of image of Hillel is the one who's driven by ahava, right? Who's animated by a sense of love for all people and wants to make it accessible and to more sort of embracing vision of the Jewish community. So these are the classic stories that exemplify that kind of approach. Similarly, the Gemara tells another story. There was another incident involving one Gentile came before Shammai and said, Shammai, convert me. You may have heard this one. Command condition. They teach me the entire Torah while I am standing on one foot. This is right. This is well known also because it's a great image. Right, you can literally see the oral Torah, you know, written Torah, you don't know what to see other than sort of, right, just a conversation. But when you have such a visual, I find that tends to stick with us. So, right, you can see him, right, as if he's standing there on one. It doesn't actually say that they stood on one foot yet, but we're going to get there, right? So, of course, what does Shammai say? So Shammai pushing away the builder's cubit in his hand, right? So he says, get out of here, right? This is a joke. What kind of mockery are you making of the Torah? This was a common measuring stick, and Shammai was a builder by trade. That's just the addition. By the way, just so you know, the bold text is the actual translation of the Talmud.
I was wondering.
And the non-bold is, this is the Rabbi Steinsaltz translation, I think I mentioned last time. So this is, they've incorporated I would say probably three quarters of the Steinsaltz Koren English translation now, that they've been publishing as separate volumes of Sosina. And those are now incorporated into the Svaria online translations. It's a great coup for them. So this is Rabbi Steinsaltz explaining, by the way, the reason that Shammai was, he didn't walk around with this, he wasn't punching people.
Stick.
That's right. This is just, it's like, don't think he's such a, like, he's not like kidding, you know, all the people who come to him. That's just what he did professionally.
Right? It reminds me of the teachers that used to go around with
the rulers
hitting the hands of left-handed writers to try to get them
to correct them. That's
correct
right.
them to write with the right hand. I can speak about that personally. So.
Just discrimination. We need a civil rights movement.
Yeah.
The lefties. All right.
So it's interesting that Shammai did it full time. Even he worked as a builder.
Oh, yeah, so the Rambam had a lot of fun with this Gemara and many, many others. As well known, the Rambam was opposed to learning in Kollel. The Rambam speaks out very, very forcefully against accepting any money in exchange for either studying Torah or, by the way, teaching Torah. Mm-hmm. Rambam believed I couldn't do what I do. The Rambam believed that no rabbi could do what rabbis do nowadays, and he believed that all rabbis need to support themselves outside of the rabbinate. This was a rejection of pretty much everything that had ever been done before him. Anything, any contemporary of his held, and the Rambam has been rejected pretty much ever since. And the reason the Rambam has been rejected is even one who accepts the spirit of the Rambam recognizes that it's impossible to build a Jewish community. It's not realistic. It's impossible to build a Jewish community in which you don't have, at some point along the way, some sort of salaried opportunity to work in the Jewish community. Otherwise, we're just not going to have teachers of Torah. We're not going to have community leaders. We're not going to have any of that. But the Rambam did make a very big deal out of this, and it's often cited in the debates around Kollel study and so on and so forth.
He managed to live up to his ideals, though.
He did, although he was supported. There's some question about how he was supported before his brother died. He had a brother, David. David, who he was very, very close with. After David dies, the Rambam says he falls into a year-long bout of depression. Mm. They're very close, and they had some sort of financial partnership. His brother was a merchant. He died out on the Indian Ocean in a tragic accident. The Rambam had tried to convince his brother not to go, and he didn't want to listen. He went, and he perished at sea. And there's some question as to the nature of their financial arrangement. Did his brother just support him? Until that time, the Rambam was not working for a living full-time, although he had training as a doctor. After that time, he had no choice, and he did indeed live with that option.
Maybe that's why he felt so strongly about it.
Right.
His personal experience.
Yeah. So did Rambam differentiate between those who just learned all day as opposed to those who actually taught classes or maybe were teachers in schools? I mean, I would think that there would be a difference.
You would think, and many have. Yeah. Not the Rambam. He was a purist on this matter, all the way. He's very extreme. I recently actually published something on this. I have a whole theory about it. I think it actually speaks to... I think the Rambam believed... I think there are a number of pieces. I think the Rambam, number one, believes that we should live lives on bare subsistence. The Rambam believed that basically you should get by with the minimum amount. I think the Rambam would have been opposed to having a fancy,
mainline homes.
Whatever, the whole nine yards. The food and the whole nine yards. The Rambam really believed, not because he was an ascetic in a Christian sense, not because he believed that the material world has anything negative about it, but because basically a person should spend, we should spend our lives focused on matters of pure substance and pure, trying to acquire wisdom and understanding. And that these other things are just distractions from all of that. That was number one. Number two, I think the Rambam had an acute sense that there is an inherent challenge to salaried religious leadership. which I don't think that the Rambam's view is necessarily the one that should be accepted as normative, but I do think it's important as a rabbi. I often reflect on the challenges of, and I think it's a larger challenge perhaps for pulpit rabbis, where basically you have a community hiring someone who's meant to be the religious authority for that community. So we all live with this, and we all see this in all of our communities, but this is an intrinsic conflict of interest. I think we need to call it out for what it is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're asking someone to become the religious authority of the people who then pay the salary and decide, you know, the future employment of this individual. And I think the Rambam believed that this arrangement has the potential to degrade the honor of the rabbinate in the community's eyes, because essentially what it does is it transforms the rabbi from a true religious leader into a community employee. Now, the Rambam's solution, many would argue, was no better, because realistically, it's highly unlikely that in today's world and in many generations and in many cultures that someone can sustain themselves and still manage to become a religious leader to study and so on and so forth without ever accepting a salary for learning or for leading, right? Or any of these kinds of things. And the Rambam maybe was superhuman, but they don't make him like the Rambam anymore. So I'm not sure that the reason the Rambam's solution was not accepted is because it's not practical. But I think that it is something that is, you know, I think even just having awareness about some of those challenges, I think is healthy for us, because sometimes there's friction, sometimes there are challenges, and I think just understanding the complexity of the dynamics, and I think the Rambam was acutely aware of some of those challenges and pointed to them, and even if we don't accept his solution as normative, I think there's some insight there. So, I mean, that's part of it. It's all on the side, but it's a... just a little bit of editorializing.
Fascinating person.
What?
Fascinating person.
The Rambam. Yes. And he took no prisoners. He just said it like he thought it was, and he just went. So that was it. Anyhow, so coming back. So yes, the Rambam does pick up on this Gemara. Anyhow, so just to finish up. So he went to gone to Shammai, and he said, "Teach me all Torah in one work," and he pushes him away with the stick. So the same Gentile came before Hillel, he converted him, and said to him, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to another." This is his famous restatement of the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha. He says it in the negative. He says, don't do to your brethren what you would not want done to yourself. That's the entire Torah. Excuse me, the rest is interpretation. Go study. So, at first glance, many have said that this passage, that this story with regard to Hillel, seems to indicate that basically these converts came to him, and although they went to Shammai, and Shammai said, sorry, you can't do it without accepting the entirety of the Torah, Hillel says, no, there should be more of an open door policy. And we should be accepting toward converts, and they'll figure it out whenever they figure it out. But basically, don't just shut the door. And some have cited this Gemara as supportive of an approach that's more tolerant in terms of the standards that maybe some have suggested even indicates that we should not require the acceptance of mitzvot. Basically, the person comes and says, well, written Torah without the oral Torah, and Hillel says, yeah, we'll figure it out later, against Shammai, and similar with regard to, and teach me the whole thing on one foot. I mean, really? He taught him, v'hatro l'recha kamocha. Right? And, you know, and
also, like such as Judaism. Like Chabad says, a tam.
Right, just like a little bit, is that really...
And it brings you in.
Right, which is beautiful, but is that, you know, but that's complicated in terms of conversion standards. Is that really something you can rely on, that now they've accepted the entirety of the mitzvot?
But here, it's interesting that it says in both cases that he converted him and then they studied.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
So I'm...
Yeah. So... Does that mean...
Is that true? Is that a precedent?
Right, but that sounds odd, because at first glance you would say... Because the question here is, what are the criteria for conversion? So while it's true that every Jew should continue learning our entire lives, there's no question about that, but that's not necessarily going to retroactively change the conversion. We don't do that. Once the conversion's done, you have to have... The criteria needs to have been met, and now a convert is a convert. That's exactly... Because otherwise... You've got the problem that we have, people questioning conversion. So although we want to encourage converts to continue studying afterward, we could never make that a condition that intrinsically, right? So you want conversions to have, you know, all the qualifications that have been met prior to conversion.
But if you have a convert who wants to convert, who knows nothing about Judaism, mm-hmm. What kind of a statement is, I'll accept all of the Torah? He doesn't know what he's accepting.
Right.
It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, he hasn't a clue. Which mitzvah?
Right, what does that it's
what does it
right.
mean? It doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But here so it's like you said, it didn't even seem to say that he accepted the Haftarah of Kamachal the off in the negative sense. He just said he converted him and then you told mm-hmm. him that. So
right.
it's not clear if there were any criteria or what the criteria were.
Right. Good. So
desire,
yeah.
the motivation.
Right. Right.
Good. So,
well,
so
I mean, technical knowledge. I guess that's what I mean. It seems right. that there wasn't any requirement.
Right. So many have cited this Gemara as apparent evidence that, you know, for a looser standard in terms of the acceptance of mitzvot, etc. If you take a look, we're going to leave out 11 for now. 11, as we mentioned last time, is the story. The Gemara says that there are consequences to not accepting a rightful convert. The Gemara basically says that there's a story about this Timna, who wanted to become a proselyte, who came to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, who didn't accept her. So she became a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esav, mm-hmm. and Amalek came from there. It's good, good Purim theme, right? Among is descended from Amalek. So this goes to the previous discussion. This is a counterweight to some of the Gemaras that talk about the challenges of accepting a convert. And the Gemara points out that when we unnecessarily close the door to someone who should rightly join the Jewish community, there are equal and opposite consequences that we have to be concerned with as well.
Wow, nobody ever cites this.
Right? Well, here we are. I have seen it.
I think you've cited it.
What?
I've heard it before.
I don't remember. I don't think I've
but
seen
I mean,
it.
But I mean, I've never seen even that approach, that attitude. Because, there's always the tradition of reject three times and make sure they really want it.
Sure, right. And Judaism has taken a non-proselytizing stance for the last 2,000 years. There's some debate at earlier points in history, but that's been pretty standard for quite some time.
Although that, to some extent, was a reaction to... to Hordus also, because Hordus was a forced conversion. I mean, his
Hordus, yeah.
Herod.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, there's a
and so since he persecuted the Jewish people right. to such an extent, mm-hmm. There was a reaction against that because mm-hmm. it was his father or his mother. I'm not sure which was a Moabite. And was forced to convert by the edge of the sword.
I think this Gemara that his mother was.
His mother, okay.
I believe so. Yeah. So that's a piece of it. And yeah, but there hasn't been a serious revisiting, I think, of that issue across the board in a meaningful way, probably for just about 2,000 years now. Look, I think this is true of, Goy had mentioned earlier in terms of leadership, rabbinic leadership, so I think it's true of leadership in general. You know, sometimes we're afraid, we say, we want to err on the side of not changing something because we don't want to ruffle feathers. It's careful not to accept a convert, and where that's appropriate, we should not accept a convert. That's true. But there are equal and opposite consequences sometimes where there should be something that changes, or someone should be accepted, or a practice, or a person should be accepted, and we refuse to. And sometimes we forget about that side of the coin. That's the nature of halachic decision making in any process in which we engage. There are consequences on both sides. Sometimes we like to convince ourselves there's like the safe option, which involves status quo, and there's the unsafe option, which involves change. But not changing is also a decision, also has consequences. So I think it's the Gemara reminds us that it's fraught. Right? This is a fraught area. I think that's true, and we have to be aware of the consequences on all sides and make the best halachic and ethical decisions that we can. And that's all really in the end of the day what we can, that's all we can do. So that's one Gemara, that's one tradition where Hillel seems to be more accepting. But there's an equal and opposite tradition, which comes up in a more traditional halachic context. The Gemara repeats in two places. I gave you one, Gemara in the Choron, source 12 on 30b, Lamed Amba. So the Gemara talks about Oved Kochavim, read the Hebrew in English here, Oved Kochavim Shavala Kabel Devrei Torah. So you have a heathen who comes to accept the words of the Torah, Chutz Midavar Echad, with the exception of one area, Im Mikablin Otel. So we don't accept this person. Riosi Rabbi Yehuda Omeri goes even further. Afilu dikto kechad midivrei sofrim. Even one special detail, a minutia, that is rabbinic, of the scribe's enactment. In other words, rabbinic legislation.
But
right?
this seems to imply that you would have to question the convert of every little minutia of halacha and get him to say yes, mm-hmm. which might take your lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Is there another way to read it, though? As the Gemara said, you have to tell them, you have to quiz the convert. By the way, we do generally quiz converts. Again, these things are sensitive, but they're right. But Bate Din do generally ask some questions. One of the differences, by the way, between some of the different Bate Din that I mentioned is that the GPS Beit Din will ask some basic questions. Rabbi Luxin spoke about that when he was here. And he was very, about
Kashrut, you know, basic.
Right, but he was saying, they asked about certain things.
Trump, they had some very, very detailed thing that I'd never heard of.
That he didn't like, yeah.
That she was able to answer in the minutia
right.
that they questioned her.
And he said he said he didn't think it was necessary to even ask that level of detail. By the way, I think it's important to say that there are other rabbinic colleagues who would say that would disagree with him and say that it is important to ask, you know, not just very generic questions, but to get some sort of specific sense. This is the debate. This is why Rabbi Luxin does conversions outside of GPS. And this is why there are many rabbis who feel that he's doing the right thing. There are other rabbis who disagree. You know, there's a legitimate live debate within the Orthodox community around these issues. And Rabbi Luxin is an important voice in that conversation. But Stu, I think you could read this a little bit differently. This is not necessarily saying that we have to ask about every minutia. It's if the convert comes to us and says, look, this whole Torah thing, this is great. I really, really like it. But, you know, this one, that's just not for me. Or this one, I'm not really interested in. Or this one I'm opposed to on ethical principle. I can't do that mitzvah. So in that case, where a convert comes and says, I'm accepting everything but if the convert says, I'm fundamentally accepting the whole thing, and I take it very seriously, that's where, you know, that, and then you say, but the convert's not going to keep every detail? Okay, but we haven't yet, as we talked about last time, we haven't yet met the person who does, right?
Yeah, we don't stone adulterers anymore.
Well, say again?
We don't stone adulterers.
Oh, you mean someone of the...
Right.
You know, if you're going to
say that, but even on relatively minor halachic infractions, you know, even people who are generally observant, there's no such thing as a person who's perfectly observant. And that's a real part of the tension. So if a person comes and says, yeah, I'm not doing that one, I love this whole thing, but that one, that's just not working for me. Like, I can't stop, you know, it's just, you know, my cheeseburger is just, you can't, you know. Look, I like this whole Judaism thing and all, but I mean...
What if it was a mitzvah we no longer can practice because of, like, we're outside of Eretz Israel or something like that? He says, like, I'm not going to keep, I don't know what, the example of something we don't
That's
keep
a great
anymore.
Question. I think it goes to this question of how we understand this idea of Kabbalah mitzvah. If we say that we require the person practice all the commandments, so then if it's not practical, it's not practical. But others would say that it's more fundamental than that. That the Kabbalah mitzvot is essentially saying, and we'll get to this, is that to be a Jew is first and foremost to commit oneself to the strictures and mandates of the Torah. Whether I understand, whether I don't understand, they're like all people, we're going to understand and appreciate certain things, other things we won't. But fundamentally, I'm accepting the Torah even where it's beyond me. So if such an individual says, well, I like all of it, but this one I don't believe in, or I wouldn't follow even if it were practical, some would say that's not fundamentally the complete acceptance of the mitzvah. So even that. But you see there's some tension here, right? You have the tradition of Hillel, which seems to militate toward a more open and accepting kind of conversion policy, the Gemara in Bechorot. There's a similar sugya, probably the most important sugya for matters of conversion is Yivamot. Three pages of Gemara there that deal with a lot of the details of conversion. And that Gemara also seems to present this idea, and it also mentions that we instruct the convert about the basics of the mitzvah. Right, so this idea of the acceptance of mitzvot being a central part is an essential part. And so many scholars have observed that there's an apparent tension between these two traditions, and the question is how to begin to resolve them. And the truth is that already the commentators on the Gemara itself in Shabbat began to address this issue. So if you take a look at Rashi, I didn't give you the English translation, but I'll read and summarize the Rashi, source 13, Yud Gimel. Toward the bottom, page 13. So Rashi talks about the interaction between Shammai and Hillel. He's actually talking about a slightly different case, but it's part of that same series of incidents. So Rashi says, why did Shammai initially push these converts away? So Hotzio ben Azifa, right? Why does Shammai just reject them? because he quotes the Gemara Mechorah that we just saw. He says, well, a convert, Shammai says, if you're not willing to accept the entirety of the mitzvot, we're not going to accept you. So that's how Rashi explains Shammai's rejection of these conversions. So how do we account for Hillel's decision to accept the convert? So Rashi continues, he says as follows. He says, it's not that Hillel said there is no fundamental requirement of ever accepting the mitzvot. It's that Hillel understood that this individual, Hillel was a master educator. He knew when he had someone right in the palm of his hands and he could read this convert. And he said, this is a person who is going to accept the mitzvot. It's just a question of how to get them to understand what that is. But fundamentally, I know that this is a convert who's willing to accept the mitzvot. So he says that Hillel v'samach, I'll read the Hebrew and explain it, v'samach al chokhmato, says Rashi, that Hillel relied on his own wisdom, right? His own educational mastery, right? Shesofo, that eventually shargilenu kabel alav, that he would convince the person to accept everything. De'lo damya ahal ledavar michutz, lechutz midavar achad. He says, this is unlike the Gemara that we just quoted, that Rashi himself just quoted from the Chora. He says, it's different, similar to the distinction we drew earlier. Rashi says, shelo yakofer b'torah shabal peh. It's not that the convert came and said, I reject Shor Shabbat. He's saying, it's too hard for me. I don't know if I'm up for it. I'm skeptical that, you know, what's explicit in the Torah that I can manage. But all these, like, you know, like the whole Eruv, you know, detail. Like, it's just like Rabbi, you know, it's just like too much for me. Right? Something that like an adolescent might say. I don't know. Right? So he wasn't rejecting it. Right? Right, Hillel just needed to bring him on board and to convince him that this would be the case. So Rashi is describing as a basic distinction between two categories. It's one thing if someone just completely rejects something, but it's another thing if I believe that eventually this person is going to follow this. It's just a question of kind of getting them fully on board. And this is an important piece because then you might say something like, look, we don't necessarily have to go through every nuance and detail of Hilchos Motza before you convert someone. There's got to be the basics in place, right? Whether Shabbos, Kashrus, Nidra, what have you. There's certain fundamentals that we have there, and we teach substantially. But no one's going to be able to learn every single halachic detail before converting because, again, the same thing, how many people in the world have learned every single halachic detail, right? Not many of us at any table can say that. And so Rashi's point is, if you're fundamentally on board, and you're fundamentally truly committed to halachic observance, and it's a matter of bringing the person on board in terms of the details, or even in terms of certain elements of faith, as Rashi continues and alludes to here as well, if there's confidence that fundamentally this person is basically bought into the system, that would be sufficient. But when I say system, I mean system of halachic observance specifically. So Rashi does of both the written and the oral law. So Rashi seems to imply here that even Hillel accepts the fundamental requirement of accepting the mitzvot and that fundamental commitment, but that if there's an understanding, there's a basic commitment, but there's going to continue to be a lifetime of learning, whether in terms of practice or faith matters, that's acceptable as well. So fundamentally, Rashi is saying the Gemara about Hillel can be read in consonance with the requirement of the acceptance of mitzvot.
Well, what I think I'm taking from all of this is that, Hillel is really about the process and where the person is in terms of conceptually accepting all mitzvot.
Right.
While Shammai is really, I mean, it's not clear to me that there is such a difference because, based on this Rashi, because based on what Shammai is saying, he's saying a person who says, I can't accept this, not because necessarily it's just hard or it's too detailed, but on some sort of, grounds that I'm just not willing for Kabbalat Ol Torah.
Right.
It's not clear that Hillel will accept someone either who he didn't see as willing to do that, but they're approaching it from different sides.
Right. Well, and it's possible that there's not a fundamental debate about the criteria for conversion, and rather the debate was really how generously they were willing to assess this individual. Or Shammai said, well, I'm just going to take you at face value. And Hillel said, no, I understand that there's a deeper commitment here. And it's just a matter of holding someone by the hand, as it were, and taking them through. And that might ultimately be really what it's about. I think that's right. If you take a look, I also gave you another passage I'm not going to read inside, but the Maharsha. The Maharsha of Shmuel Edels was one of the great commentators on both Halakha and Agada. If you take a look at the back of any Gemara, you'll see that there's a section called the Maharsha. And the Maharsha has two sections. There's a Halachic section, he has commentaries on Agada. And because there are so many commentaries that have been published on Talmudic Halakha, but fewer commentaries that have been published on Talmudic Agada, the Maharsha has been particularly well known and oft cited for his commentary to the Agadot of the Gemara. So it's very common to study a Gemara that has an Agadic passage and to say, okay, what does the Maharsha have to say about this? That's a very common kind of thing to do, and it's considered to be one of the classic sources in that regard. So the Maharsha in source 14 also, kind of like Rashi, grapples with this question of what was the difference between Shammai and Hillel, and how exactly are we to understand it? And essentially, he has a similar kind of approach, and he explains that it didn't necessarily mean initially. He actually suggests that a more metaphorical reading that the converts actually is interesting. Did not necessarily mean to say that. Teach me the entire Torah while I'm standing here on one foot. Like, he wasn't necessarily being a mechutzaf, you know? Like, you know, hey, Rabbi, you know? It's just, look, I got 15 seconds, busy guy, okay? So let's get this conversion done. Will you, Rabbi? Right? It wasn't like that. But rather, it was metaphorical. What he's saying is, can you please teach me the entire Torah by giving me a foundation for the Torah? In other words, I'm a person who wants to see not just the trees, but I want to see the forest as well. What is this fundamentally about? And so he says, teach me the entire thing while standing on one foot, i.e. not I'm in a rush and to get out of here, you know, send me the conversion, Rabbi, but teach me the underlying principles of the Torah. And Shammai says, right, what are you talking about? Get out of here. Like, what is this, a joke? And Hillel understands that he's really asking to be taught the fundamentals and not just the details. And Hillel says, well, if you had to ask me what's the one overriding principle of the Torah, it's not to mistreat your neighbor. Right? It's to treat them at minimum as you would want to be treated yourself. Which is a beautiful and inspiring thought, which is true in the Gemara, but especially true according to the Maharsha. We see that sometimes, very often, we think of the Torah exclusively in terms of the rituals, and he'll saying, actually, if you were to ask me, it would be the interpersonal relationships that are even more foundational. Not that we'd want to choose between them, but Hillel says, don't overlook the importance and centrality of that category as well. That's an equally essential, if not more essential, part of what ultimately the Torah is all about, and it's to that that Hillel is responding. Now, the Maharsha, I don't think, is the face reading of the Gemara. Let's acknowledge that it's not necessarily the simple reading. It really does sound like he was asking to hurry up, and I think Rashi understands it that way. But I think the Maharsha is grappling with this problem, and he sees that there's an issue here, and he wants to maintain the other Gemara standards for conversion, try to understand why Hillel was so receptive as well to this individual, and so he explains it in this way. But you see again that the commentaries are grappling and trying to retain the basic concept of accepting the mitzvah. The other thing I should say about the apparent conflict between these two Gemarot is that, in general, if we have halachic texts and we put them alongside agadic texts, typically the strictly halachic texts are more determinative in terms of matters of halacha. Agada is extremely important in terms of framing the larger worldview. But all things being equal, if you have a midrash alongside a strict halacha, the midrash will be weighed. But if in the end of the day there were an irreconcilable conflict, which I don't think there is in this case, but if there were, we would choose to follow the strict halachic ruling because it was really given in a practical sense. And I think that's an important piece as well to understanding the conversation. So that's sort of the Talmudic framing and background. The question is, what's the practical halacha? And where do we go from here? So time is a little late, and so I'm going to start referencing the sources. I'm not going to read all of them inside. But the striking thing, if you take a look, is the Rambam, Maimonides, in his treatment, his codification of the requirements of conversion in his laws of Yisurei Biyah, forbidden intercourse, which is where he discusses Hilchok Yerut, Peri Yugim Halacha Yud Zayin, chapter 13, Halacha 17. The Rambam, although he says that one should preferably inform the potential convert about the mitzvot, the Rambam says that if we did not check the potential convert and inform that individual about the mitzvot, and nonetheless that convert goes ahead and immerses in a mikvah before the three judges, and there's a proper protocol of conversion that's followed. So the Rambam says that ultimately Hari Zeger. So such a person is considered to be a convert. And he says even if that person later goes back and reverts to idolatry or what have you. Remember we said earlier, once there's a conversion, it's over. If a person becomes a sinner afterward, fine. But that's not in of itself reason to undermine or question the conversion. That's just sinful behavior.
And so this is in conflict of what we talked about last time, what's happening in Haredi, you know.
So that's right. So the Rambam, right. So the Rambam seems to be saying this. Now, the challenges for the Rambam and this interpretation of the Rambam, and by the way, the Shulchan Aruch seems to codify this Rambam the way that it is. The Shulchan Aruch will very often, or Yosef Karo writing in the 16th century in Sfat, will often, not always, but he often does just cite the Rambam as authoritative and basically quote him more or less verbatim, which is essentially what he does here in Yerodeah. The challenge with this is manifold. Number one, the overwhelming majority of medieval commentaries don't seem to accept this position. The generally accepted position did seem to be that accepting Siddur Tzvot is a prerequisite for conversion. The details we could discuss, but that fundamentally it is a criteria for conversion, number one. Number two, the Gemaras that the Rambam himself is citing, and the Gemara in Bechorot, etc., seem to indicate otherwise. They seem to indicate that there is such a requirement. And the Rambam himself elsewhere seems to say that we do have to ask the convert, are you willing to accept all the mitzvot? So which one is it? Do we have to, is it a sine qua non, is it a prerequisite, or is it not? The same thing for the Shulchan Aruch. And so the stakes become very, very high. And this is a very, very big deal. And so there are two strands of thought within the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. There is a minority view among the commentators that accepts this and says, yeah, the Rambam is saying that it's ideal to require the acceptance of mitzvot, but bottom line, the Rambam says, if we convert someone without the acceptance of mitzvot, it's valid. There is such a view. They cite the story of Hillel. They cite as well, on the bottom page 15, source 17, a story about a Gentile who was captured among the nations, never had any reason to learn anything about Judaism whatsoever, and converted, is accepted as a convert, even though seems to know nothing. It's like what Stuart was saying earlier. I mean, if you really don't know what it is that you're accepting, say, oh, it's Kabbalat al Mitzvot. Sure, that sounds great. Oh, you mean I can't go to the non-kosher restaurants? And so, you mean, right, that's it, right? You signed away my life, right? my fortunes, or, Jewish community, I know what I was signing. That kind of thing. So some cite that in support of that reading of Maimonides. And there's one commentary, the Bach, who's the Bayit Chadash, or Viol Circus, one of the greatest last names in the history of Halakha. The Bach actually seems to interpret the Rambam this way. In source 18, he writes, and again, I apologize all the Hebrew, but the Bach actually writes that, Af al pi shekatav harambam, dechatav harambam, even though the Rambam wrote that it is accepted despite the lack of acceptance of mitzvot, however, he says, Tosfot and the Rosh and all the others disagree and say that acceptance of mitzvot is a sine qua non. So there is a reading of the Rambam that says that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch would accept post facto such a convert who did not accept mitzvot. However, and that's a big capital H, there are many important things militating against that. Number one, again, the overwhelming majority of Rishonim don't accept that. The Rambam, number two, seems to contradict himself in the Shulchan Aruch by the same token by quoting those passages. And the Rambam talks about there is such a requirement. Number three, we're only talking about post facto.
Right.
That's very important to say. If we're talking about our question here is what should our policy be? Should we accept a convert without commitment to mitzvot? Right? That's one thing to say, someone who went ahead and did so, okay, do we accept it or not? But it's another thing to say, what should we be doing in the first place? We'll talk about this next time. We'll talk about it could be that there's a concept that she'at harchak, right, is that a very difficult scenario is comparable to a bidiyavad, is post facto. So when we find it in an extremely exigent circumstance, maybe there's more room for leniency. So we have Russian Olim, we're coming to the state of Israel, and we're concerned that they're going to be marrying, they're serving the army, and they're going to our schools, and we're going to have massive rates of intermarriage, and we're going to have children running around the Jewish state that we think are Jewish, but are not halachically Jewish, and they're going to be marrying for many generations. This is a nightmare. So You know, maybe that's a different situation. We'll have to talk about that next week. But if we're talking about an American policy, maybe it's not. It doesn't really necessarily fall into the post facto category, and so that would be different. And then the last piece of it is even the Bach, who is interpreting the Rambam this way, let's be intellectually accurate about this, right? In Source 18, Reveal Circus, he's not endorsing the view of the Rambam. He's saying the Rambam is a minority view who, on his reading, accepts a convert post facto without the acceptance of mitzvot, but we don't follow that. So even the Achron, even the later commentary, who read Maimonides in this way, read so while rejecting him. And so on this basis, I would say it's fair to say that the overwhelming majority view, but not the universal view. I would say this very, very strong majority view among the major halachic decisors of the 20th century is that if a convert does not accept the mitzvot, again, what that looks like, the devil is in the details, and that's the never-ending question, what does that mean? But at least as a basic requirement, I would say the overwhelming majority of 20th century halachic decisors have accepted the acceptance of the tzavot as a basic prerequisite for conversion, that immersion is necessary, and that for a male, circumcision would be necessary, but for both male and female, acceptance of mitzvot is going to be needed. This is the view, for example, of Rav Kook. I gave to you in Source 19. This is from his Responsa in Yoredeya. That's his view there. If you look at Source 20, this is the view of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was one of the great Yerushalmi poskim, lived in Yerushalayim. In the 20th century, as an aside, he had a close relationship with one of Meirbein, with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who went to visit with Rav Shlomo Zalman every year on Sukkot. He's probably the only rabbi, Rosh Yeshiva / Harvard PhD, who met with Rav Shlomo Zalman on any sort of regular basis. They had a not close relationship, but they had a meaningful relationship. And Lichtenstein wrote a very moving eulogy after Rav Shlomo Zalman passed away, which is published. It's very beautiful. Rav Shlomo Zalman was strict on this matter. Rav Moshe Feinstein in Source 21. Again, just giving you an overview in Solomon Hebrew here. If you want to take a look, feel free to read it through. But Rav Moshe quotes his own father and says, this is a very firm position that he has. He says he doesn't even begin to understand the logic of rabbis who act differently. He's a somewhat harsh language here. He can be harsher, but he's pretty firm. He clarifies that there's a distinction between motivation and the content of my acceptance of mitzvah. Let me explain what I mean by that. He says there's a difference between someone who's motivated by marriage, but although the initial motivation was marriage, I fully commit myself to accepting the mitzvot, versus someone who is not fundamentally committed to the observance of mitzvot. He says the former, we do not perform lichatchila, preferably, but post facto is accepted. Because in the end of the day, there is an acceptance of the mitzvot. Okay, initially my motivation was for the sake of marriage, but it is something that's accepted after the fact. But what Rav Moshe does not understand is someone who at no point truly commits him or herself to the acceptance of mitzvot, and nonetheless the rabbi converts such a person. Rav Moshe says, this rabbi is not doing a favor to this person. Because what you're doing is you're telling this person that they're converted, and it's not a real conversion. Says you're not doing anyone any favors in this case. And that's Rav Moshe. Rav Soloveitchik also clearly came down on this side. Rav Soloveitchik is in Source 22. This is taken, it's a little bit faded. It's the best that I could do. This is a footnote from Rav Soloveitchik's essay, Kol Dodi Dofeik. Kol Dodi Dofeik. Is that familiar to anyone here? Kol Dodi Dofeik, yeah. So Kol Dodi Dofeik also publishes Fate and Destiny, is the Rav's reflections on the Holocaust. And it's those who have not seen it, it's highly recommended, and I'm happy to lend you or get you a copy. It's an incredibly inspiring and soaring essay, and he describes the six knocks that God gave on the Jewish doorstep, as it were, after the Holocaust. that it is now our responsibility to respond to proactively. And this is one of his, this is the Rav Zinus credo. And it's an extraordinarily beautiful essay. In a footnote, he has an extensive discussion about conversion and so on and so forth. And he's very strict on this issue. And he quotes the passage from Maimonides that I mentioned. And he says as follows. He says, the reason the Rambam omits this is not because acceptance of mitzvot is something that we can pass on. He says quite the opposite. He says there's a distinction between the procedures of conversion and its essence. The procedures of conversion are immersion in the mikvah, the beitin, are for male circumcision, but the essence of what it means to be Jewish is to have, as it were, literally or figuratively stood at Sinai and accepted the mitzvot. That was the fundamental moment in Jewish history. Without that, it's just not Jewishness. So he says, the Rambam omits it, not because it's not necessary, quite the opposite. It's because the Rambam there is describing the procedures of conversion. That's not a procedure. It is the heart and soul of conversion. So that's what he says. I said that this is the overwhelming majority of you, and I just cited four major, and we could cite another 40 major halachic decisors.
But the Minchat Shlomo appears to accept the conversion.
He does not accept
Because he says now the convert will violate prohibitions such as Shabbat and Tashrit, which before the conversion did not constitute a violation of God's word. So what I think he's saying is that people who convert them are violating the prohibition of Mishnei Iver, but he's not saying that they're not Jewish.
No, if you read it carefully, he says it's only according to their opinion. He says, in my opinion, they're not Jewish. Even in their opinion, why would you go ahead with such a conversion? You think it's a legitimate conversion, so what are you doing? You're taking a Gentile, who's not obligated in all these mitzvot, and therefore has a great standing, you know, in their divine checklist, as it were. And you're converting them, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says, even according to those who think that it is legitimate conversion, you're not helping because you're converting this individual, and then they're standing there and they're every single Shabbat, they're driving and they're violating a whole list of laws, and right, and they're eating non-kosher food, they're not keeping kashrut, etc. So he says very clearly, he says, four lines in the bottom, for example, he says, "Af imhim to'im lachashuv shehim girun gemurin." Even if they err, even if they make the mistake of thinking that these are legitimate conversions, he says, "Afilu haki." Even so, gam l'shitatam. Even according to their opinion, which I reject, even according to they who believe that it is legitimate conversion, okay, says they're still in violation of stumbling, placing a stumbling block before a blind man because they are causing this individual.
Okay,
to
so the English does not really reflect the Hebrew that well.
Oh, so I apologize. You know what? I think I may have. You didn't fill it in fully. I apologize.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I'm glad I asked the question. Good. It read differently.
I'll go back and... These sheets are available publicly, so I have to go back and correct it. So I'm glad you raised it. We're running late, so I want to wrap up. But I just want to observe, I mentioned before, the overwhelming majority of 20th century, 21st century decisors is that it is an absolute prerequisite, but there is a minority view that disagreed. And the minority that disagreed really was disagreeing in two respects. Number one, there were those who said that acceptance of mitzvot is not a prerequisite. And number two, there's those who said that that we can even preferably accept a convert, for example, for the sake of marriage or in other exigent circumstances. The Sephardic tradition, in general, historically, was more lenient with regard to matters of conversion than the Ashkenazic one. That's number one. And in general, it was Sephardic custom, I believe, in many Sephardic communities, despite the Syrian strictures, but traditionally in many Sephardic communities, it was quite common to accept converts for the sake of marriage. That's the general. That was a very common practice in Sephardic communities as opposed to the Ashkenazic practice. That's number one. When Dr. Mark Shapiro was here speaking to her students, he mentioned this and discussed this a little bit with them as well in context of Ashkenazic versus Sephardic practice. It was an interesting conversation. The other piece was Rav Uziel. Rav Uziel was the first Sephardic chief rabbi of the State of Israel. And Rav Uziel dealt with many of these questions of conversion that they were rampant at his time, and he took a very lenient position. And he believes that it's not true. He cited the Rambam, and he cited the Shulchan Aruch. He says, look, I'm a Sephardi. The Rambam is a great Sephardic authority. Shulchan Aruch is the major codifier of Sephardic practice. And he believed that the Bach's reading that we saw earlier of the Rambam of Shulchan Aruch, that acceptance of Zod is not a sine qua non for conversion, is at least post facto, is legitimate. Is a matter of practical halacha. Gave it to you as an example in source 23. A non-Jew who has been circumcised and has immersed in the mikvah with the purpose of conversion, we do not require that he observe the mitzvah. The Beit Din does not even need to know that he will observe mitzvah, for otherwise converts will not be accepted in Israel. So notice this is a very embracing kind of vision. He quotes Hillel, right? Others would say Hillel's case is different, like Rashi and the Marsha, but he quotes Hillel in support of his view. The requirement for mitzvot is not an indispensable component of the conversion, even the chatchila. It's not even ideally an absolute necessity. It is permissible to accept male and female converts, even if it is known to us that they will not fulfill the mitzvah. Because now this is where he like hedges. Well, eventually they will, right? Like there's a little bit of pillow in there. We're obligated to open the door for them. And if they do not fulfill mitzvot, they will bear their sins, and we are free from responsibility for this. Oh. That's back at Shlomo Zalman. I don't think it's a direct response, but it's a response to the substance of that claim. Rav Uziel has been championed by some who, in America as well, for example, Rabbi Mark Angel, for those who know the name. Right? Mark Angel is the Rabbi Emeritus of the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue in Manhattan, in the Upper West Side. And Rabbi Angel has been a major champion of more open and less restrictive standards for conversion. I think I quoted him earlier in here. He critiqued the GPS quite extensively, quite loudly, and he always cites Vuziel in support of his view. I think he believes that even Ashkenazim should be more lenient, but certainly within the Sephardic tradition, Rabbi Angel is far Spanish Portuguese. He's of Sephardic heritage. He cites Rav Uziel as the great champion of this approach. He contrasts Rav Cook on the one hand with Rav Uziel and believes that Rav Uziel's policy should be the one that our community accepts today. Obviously, the Rabbinical Council of America is, you know, with given Rav Soloveitchik's influence there, and given that the overwhelming majority of halachizers did not accept this, they've gone in a different direction. And so there really is a halachic difference of opinion, and a very basic one. Remember, the Rav was the one who was saying, it's not just a procedure of conversion, it's the very heart and soul of conversion. There are other Orthodox rabbis in America, a minority, more to the left, but they're saying, no, Rav Uziel should be our model. So it's not just politics. Sometimes we see these things and we say, oh, it's just rabbinic politics. And rabbis have politics too, there's no question about that. But they also have halachic disputes. And this is a grounded halachic dispute where the clear majority opinion, I think, is on one side, but there is Rav Uziel on the other, and that is also part of the conversion conversation in our community today. The hour is late, so I think I'm going to leave Rav David C. Hoffman for next time. But he does open the question of, okay, if we require the acceptance of mitzvot, does that mean how much do we have to ask? You know, where is the don't ask, don't tell policy legitimate? Not as a way of just like not being honest, but like how far do you have to go? being realistic. And is that something that can help with very difficult conversion questions? And there was one scenario that he faced in Germany in the early 20th century, which is very relevant. So there's a summary here. You can start to look at it. We'll give it proper attention next week. And then our primary discussion next time, Tuesday, is going to be the other side of the pond, as it were, right? Or the ocean, as the case may be, and take a look at some of the challenges in Israel. And we're going to look and say, okay, if the majority of poskim say that we require the acceptance of its vote as a sine qua non, as an absolute prerequisite when it comes to classic cases of conversion, maybe there are other instances of children's conversion which might be different. The Gemara has a whole category of parents who convert the child. Now, a child in halacha is not considered a bar dat. In other words, is not considered to have the ability to make independent decisions and to have that kind of intellectual capacity. And that has all sorts of other ramifications in halacha. Well, maybe with regards to the Russians, we're not going to convert the first generation of Olim, but maybe the children who are under Bar and Bat Mitzvah respectively, maybe one way to deal with the conversion crisis is to convert the children, not require mitzvot, because that's a different category of conversion altogether. And then, right now, we wouldn't do this preferably, but if we have the potential for mass assimilation in Israel, maybe our hands are tied and we have no choice. Is that a legitimate halachic alternative? And then are there ramifications back for the American scene when it comes to children's conversion? Maybe that's different. Maybe if someone brings forward a questionable conversion, there might be a distinction between whether that person was converted as an adult or converted as a child. Is that going to be helpful for the conversation? Is that different? So these are some of the kinds of questions that the God willing will explore next time.
The children's conversion would be a mass conversion or just individual?
In Israel?
Yeah.
Either way. I mean, hopefully we're going to take the opportunity to provide some sort of education around the conversion and make it a meaningful religious experience. Mm-hmm. These are people who are coming from a culture in which there was no Jewish education by design for a very long period of time. So I think that it wouldn't just be like, you know, waving of the wand, now you're all Jewish, but there would be some sort of process of learning, but that would be true even if the family is not really halakhically observant. The Russian families overwhelmingly are not even close. It's not Shia. It's just not ballpark where they are for the most part, but maybe there can be some education about that.
Do you convert in infancy?
You could.
So...
You convert, it would be family education in that case, obviously. But that could be possibility as well.